Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. This afternoon at the tea time, people gathered and were asking some questions and having a discussion, Dharma discussion. And one of the things that came to mind as the discussion proceeded was having heard a story that above the gate of the ancient Buddhist monastic university in India, Nalanda University, there was supposed to have been an inscription, 10,000 monks, 10,000 religions. No, not even 10,000 Buddhisms. But there was, at the height of its development, Nalanda University had that number of monastics living there, and it's an interesting idea or concept or a way of reflecting on things. That even though it's obviously a Buddhist institution. And that's everyone's walking around wearing pretty much the same uniforms. Still, there was the recognition of the individuality or the uniqueness of the spiritual path. So, whether we call ourselves Buddhists or we call ourselves Christians or we call ourselves agnostic or we determinedly don't call ourselves anything. This is Mendocino County, of course. One eschews labels. I'm not an anything. Even if you are walking, you go around to Buddhist retreats or live in Buddhist monasteries, still people still claim, I'm not a Buddhist. I don't want to be belong. I don't want to belong to an ism. I don't want to be labeled. I don't want to be confined. So whatever the way we speak or think about our religious disposition, whether we align ourselves with a particular group, however we call it, what that inscription above the gate implies that irrespective really of the external patterning of things, it still remains up to each one of us to find our own unique way, because every single one of us has a unique body, a unique mind. We have unique patterns of experience, and even though that there's certain similarities, that the basic physical structures, the skull and skeleton, bones, and form the structure of the body, or mental structures, the ways of thinking and feeling, staying alive, breathing, eating, and so forth. These we have in common, obviously. But when it comes down to really knowing the mind, really knowing the body, knowing the fundamental reality of things, then it really is up to each one of us to find our way, to get to know the truth of the way things are via this very body, this very mind, this heart of ours. So that even though we might have a very strong commitment to a particular religious form, say, towards Buddhism, Northern Buddhism, Southern Buddhism, Mahayana, Theravada, or towards different forms of Hinduism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam or no religion, whatever it might be, in a sense, if we don't recognize that it's up to each one of us to find our own way within, then even though on one level we have a lot of faith and commitment to a particular group or style or tradition, religious form, that commitment can't really bear the fruit, can't really bring the result, the best result that would be possible, that is there in the potential of things, if we really know our own heart, if we really know our own nature and make that the focus of our attention. In different Buddhist traditions or different religions, we have different ways of describing what we are as human beings and what the universe is and how it's all put together. And oftentimes we seek for certainty or for direction, for stability in the way that we describe ourselves, the nature of the body, the nature of the mind, the nature of the Atman or the soul or the ultimate reality of things, the nature of God, the nature of mind. We can take all kinds of different ideas and conceptual forms and take them and validly describe our experience of ourselves, of life, of the world, and to create a quality of order or a way of orienting ourselves in the greater pattern of things. And so this is what religions and philosophies do and have always done ever since human beings first started to think at all and contemplate our own existence, 100,000 years ago or so, maybe 150,000. So it takes the shape of these different religious forms and cultures, cultures of spirituality, different psychologies and philosophies. So this is very understandable. It's natural for us to try and seek the pattern of things, to recognize how does this thing work? How does this all fit together? And just as is a part of our physical survival, we have to know, which are the trees which have the berries on? Which are the animals that are going to eat me? Which are the ones that I can eat? What are the signs that are on the surface of the ground that tells me there's something good to eat underneath? What's dangerous? What's valuable? What's going to provide safety? And so on. We have powerful instincts in our makeup that help us to survive in the world. And so similarly, on a psychological or spiritual level, we map things out in a similar way. Oh, that's this is the area of the mind that it brings happiness, or this is a quality that brings unhappiness. Just as when we're thinking of ourselves as hunter gatherers, we kind of know where the bush is, where the berries are, and that I remember last time. Well, they look really delicious, but last time they really gave me the collywobbles, and. That was pretty nasty. And so, okay, they look good, but avoid those ones. And those ones, you walk a little bit further and you find that a different bush, different kind of berry, but they're really good to eat. They're delicious. And where the swamps are, where the good shelter is, and so on. So within our own minds, we start to recognize the things that bring happiness, the things that bring unhappiness, the things that bring the harmonious and wholesome qualities in our life, and things that bring confusion and chaos and conflict within ourselves. So there's dozens and dozens of different ways that we can describe who and what we are, the different patterns we can draw to make sense of the way we experience things inside ourselves, outside ourselves, and how we fit in the world and fit together with each other. And the instinct is to try and find certainty or security or predictability out of those patterns. Our description of the world. I am this kind of a person, that kind of a person. And we take those descriptions and invest in them, and we try to make and try to use them to make as much sense as we possibly can out of life. And that's all reasonable and good. But one of the greatest spiritual mistakes that we make in all religious traditions, whether it's Mahayana Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism, Northern or Southern tradition, whether it's Vajrayana Buddhism or Christianity or Islam, Hinduism, Judaism, paganism, every kind of religious form, is that we can try to find an absolutely reliable and certain, permanent, dependable structure, or just in the ideas or the descriptions in the patterns of things, trying to describe the ultimate reality of things, the ultimate cause of things. Where did it all come from? Why are we here? What exactly are we as a person? And we can invest incredible amounts of time and effort trying to create the perfect descriptions, the perfect description of the nature of God, the nature of the world, and the purpose of life, how it all began, where it's all going, why am I here? And not to belittle that, I mean, certainly that's been a noble effort that humans have put their hearts into, and there's libraries, and billions of words, I'm sure, have been written on these themes. But one thing that we can notice is that no matter how perfect the description is, somehow we can still feel out of whack with life. We can still feel that sense of dislocation, a disorientation, alienation. Even if we've got the perfect description and we feel it all lines up absolutely brilliantly, and we've got all the answers for everything, still mysteriously we can find ourselves feeling separate, feeling lost, feeling frustrated, feeling irritated, incomplete in being separated from what we love, or burdened by being unable to escape from what we don't like, just plain frustrated for not getting what we want, limited because we don't feel free. And so that often our response is just to try and get a better description, or kind of get a more accurate description of what's going on. We go after the world of ideas and beliefs and spiritual concepts. One of the things that that certainly drew me towards the Buddha's teaching, and what a gift that it can provide for everybody, whether regardless of religious orientation and particular lineage or conditioning or lack thereof, is the insight that the Buddha had in the fact that you can never find a perfect description of reality. You can't find a perfect description of what we are. You can't find a perfect description of the ultimate beginning of things. And the Buddha was a great one for lists. He had hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of different lists that he created of different spiritual or psychological qualities, experiential qualities. And one of the lists is the list of the four imponderables. The four imponderables are things that the thinking mind cannot get itself around. If you try to figure them out, you'll either go crazy or your head will explode into seven pieces, apparently. And the four imponderables are the range of the mind of a fully enlightened being, all of the levels of meditative absorption, all of the complexities of the workings of karma, cause and effect, and the last one, the ultimate beginning of things. Yeah, and he said, if you try to figure it out, you'll either go crazy or your head will explode. The thinking mind, it doesn't have enough dimensions. It's like in the realm of physics, that nowadays physicists often talk about not just the three dimensions of space and the fourth dimension of time, but other dimensions as well, like in more modern physical theories like string theory. They'll talk about having an extra 10 or 11 dimensions curled up that are in kind of in tiny little spirals that sort of function at an ultra microscopic level, or even 23 dimensions. I mean, if you're trying to imagine 10 dimensional space, even just three dimensions in time, you know, we can work with that. Okay, yeah, that's doable. But more than that, 4 dimensions, 5 dimensions, 10, 11 dimensions, just the thinking mind can't stretch to it. You know, sometimes in these sort of popular science books, you'll see sometimes these diagrams trying to represent some of these multidimensional states, and they have these extraordinarily strange, knotted, contorted patterns that they look like someone has gone into a psychotic episode at a knitting conference. You know, and that's just representing the space in that particular domain. This is what 11-dimensional space looks like. You know, if you put it in ink on a 2-dimensional page. In the thinking mind, the imagining mind, can't grasp it. It's got too many dimensions. And if you can't manage 10, then 23 is totally out of the question. It's unimaginable. The thinking mind, the senses are conditioned to the 3D world and the realm of time, so that all our imagination, our thinking, our perception is all geared to coming up with those same patterns. It can't bring up a pattern of 10-dimensional space because it's never known. It doesn't have the equipment to measure that, to know that. It's not geared for that, so it can't do it. So the Buddha had this approach of saying, well, it's unimaginable, it's imponderable, so don't bother trying. And so he was somewhat unique in consciously laying aside concerns with all of these metaphysical questions about, you know, what was the origin of the universe, or what's the nature of ultimate reality, what happens to an enlightened being when at the death of the body, when their life comes to an end. He wouldn't answer those questions, and when he was challenged on this and said, well, obviously you don't answer these questions because you don't really know, you know. So that's why you don't answer. If you knew, you would give us an answer. Like all the other philosophers, they all come up with answers. And the Buddha said, well, no, the reason why I don't answer is not because I don't know. It's because these things are not useful. And there's a famous analogy where he reached down to the floor of the forest and picked up a handful of leaves. And actually, this is the logo of our Bhayagiri monastery. Speaking of representations on the printed page. There's a handful of leaves. And the handful of leaves, he said, what do you think is more, the number of leaves in my hand or the number of leaves in the forest? And of course it's a bit of a rhetorical question, and they reply, well, the leaves in your hand are very, very few, and the leaves in the forest, this forest of Singsapa trees, is very, very many. And the Buddha said, so too, what I know can be compared to the leaves on the trees. What I teach you can be compared to the leaves in my hand. So he deliberately put out a limited teaching, not trying to create the perfect model for the universe, for the nature of mind, the nature of ultimate reality, the origin of things, and the ultimate fate of humankind, but instead deliberately limited what he taught about. He said, what I teach you is the origin of that feeling of dissatisfaction, of alienation, that feeling of wrongness, or dukkha. And I teach you the origin of that, how that, where that comes from. And the cessation of that, the fact that that feeling of wrongness, of alienation, of out-of-orderedness, of dukkha, that can end, that life can be experienced, can be known totally harmoniously. Life can be things can be known with no quality of wrongness, of lack of order whatsoever. And then describing the path to that, how does one arrive? How does one train the heart to arrive at that quality of harmonization? So an analogy for this that he gave was that of the soldier wounded on the battlefield, shot with a poisoned arrow. And so we might feel, yeah, but I mean, if he does know all the stuff in the forest, it may be great to know that. You know, I mean, if he does understand where it all came from and what is the fundamental nature of mind and what a human being really is in its essence, and you know, what's the point of this all? Where it's all going? What's the true secret of the workings cause and effect? Surely he could tell us, you know, all the wonderful, interesting, fascinating details. And he says, like a wounded warrior on the battlefield, shot with a poisoned arrow, and then the field surgeon comes up and is just about to pluck out the arrow, and then the soldier says, "Don't touch it, don't put it out. Don't put it out until you find out the name of the soldier who shot me. I want to know his name. I want to know his mother's name, his father's name, names of all his brothers and sisters. I want to know what village he came from, what province that's in, what street he lives on. You know, is it a small house, a medium-sized house? Is it a big house that he lives in? And was he a tall guy? Was he a medium-sized guy? Was he a short guy? Was he fair-skinned? Was he golden-skinned? Was he brown-skinned? Was he dark-skinned? Was he..." And you can understand, this is a kind of Buddhist shaggy dog story. It kind of goes on and on and on and on, like for a page and a half of all these details. You know, what kind of wood is the arrow made from? Is it pine wood? Is it oak wood? Is it birch wood? Is it beech wood? Is it salar tree wood? Is it teak wood? Yeah. Is it, what kind of feathers are used to fletch the arrow? Is it peacock feathers? Is it chicken feathers? Is it goose feathers? Is it sparrow feathers? Is it owl feathers? Is it hawk feathers? Is it eagle feathers? What kind of arrowhead is it on it? And he just goes riffing along on these incredible lists of things. And he says, surely, by the time the surgeon has found out the answers to all these questions, that this soldier will have succumbed to the wound and will have died. So surely it's better just when wounded on the battlefield to pluck out the arrow, treat the wound, extract the poison, and then you can leave in a state of health, in a state of well-being. So this is an interesting way to approach spiritual life and spiritual practice, and is sort of a central feature of the Buddhist tradition, at least particularly in the southern Buddhist tradition, is to avoid many of those metaphysical questions and to bring the attention more and more to what is the essential process whereby we can bring our life here and now into harmony with the way things are. And so that... what the teachings on meditation and on conduct and on the results of action point to. Now, it's also, as I said at the beginning, 10,000 monks, 10,000 meditators, 10,000 religions. We each have to find our own way. So it's not just, even though I say these things and say, the Buddha taught this and this is the approach, it's also part of the process whereby we listen to these kind of teachings, listen to these principles, pay attention to them, and then weigh them up for ourselves. Another very famous teaching called the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha was passing through a village and the people there, the village of Kesaputta, the Kalama people, and this is actually there's a small village in the same place in India, and a huge stupa that's just being excavated there, actually even larger than the Borobudur stupa in Indonesia. It's probably the biggest Buddhist religious monument in the world in this particular village, and this stupa this like, huge shrine was built, apparently because it was in reverence to this being the place where the Buddha gave this teaching in particular. And the teaching was given because when he went through this village, the people said to the Buddha, well, we get all kinds of yogis and philosophers and sannyasins, teachers, gurus, sages, sadhus wandering through here, and everyone has their own philosophy, everyone has their own way of talking about things, and they all say, I'm right and all the other guys are wrong. You know, that we have you know, all manner of saints and sages, you know, monks and nuns of every kind of lineage and philosophy, and they all come through and they all speak with great confidence, and they all say that what they're telling us is true and everybody else is incorrect. So how on earth do we figure out who's right and who's wrong? How do we choose what to follow? So the Buddha then came up with this beautiful phrase. He says, Kalamas, it is appropriate that you are in doubt because you doubt that which should be doubted. Because you don't know. You know, you are uncertain, and therefore the feeling of doubt arises. So it's quite appropriate because you don't know. Therefore, this is the feeling that comes with that. And then the key teaching that he gives in this instance is that he said, when you hear a spiritual teacher, when you want to relate to spiritual teachings, you shouldn't take things and believe them just because they're written down in a holy scripture, just because they are hammered out by logic or by inductive or deductive reasoning. You shouldn't believe them just because they were passed on to you by your parents, or just because everybody else that you know and live with, they believe the same things. You shouldn't believe them just because they come from a wise and trusted teacher. There's this whole list of 10 different criteria. And then he said, it's rather that you should listen carefully to what is said and then weigh it in your own experience. How does this apply? You know, take it, use it. Does this lead towards harmony or disharmony? Does it lead towards happiness or unhappiness? Does it lead towards peace or towards confusion? What does it lead to? What's the result of it? And he said, and those things that you listen to and that you apply and you see that they lead towards happiness, towards clarity, towards peacefulness, towards harmony between yourselves and others, then take them and use them. And those things that lead towards confusion and conflict and disharmony, agitation within yourself and between yourself and others, then leave those aside. And even discouraging them from believing him. You know, he says, don't believe what I say, but take it, you know, try it out and see whether it's true. And our teacher, Ajahn Chah, felt this was such an important principle that he would recount this teaching very, very often. And also an incident where the Buddha was sitting next to his chief disciple, Sariputta, and he gave a teaching, and at the end of it, he turned to Sariputta and said, have you ever heard me give this teaching before? And Sariputta said, no, I never heard you ever give this kind of a teaching before. He said, well, I've never heard it before either. Yeah. It occurred to me as I was speaking, so it was unique to me as well. And so then he said, well, Sariputta, you know, this unique teaching, do you believe that it's true? And then he says to the Buddha, not yet. And the Buddha said, you know, why is that? And Sariputta said, well, because I haven't yet had a chance to apply it and test it and see whether it's true. And then, you know, in the context of, you know, here you are with someone supposed to be fully enlightened, you know, absolutely flawlessly wise being, and their chief disciple is sitting there in the middle of a public assembly. Be like Tanyanika interrupt me. I said to him, do you think what I'm saying is making any sense, Venerable? Is this true? And he says, well, I don't believe it yet. He said, what? He's being really cheeky. How can he be so rude? And, you know, that's how can it be that the chief disciple doesn't have faith in the elder's teaching? That's outrageous. That's appalling. That's rude. That's The guy's totally out of order. But then the Buddha said, good, Sariputta, good, this is excellent. Yeah, well done. That's the right answer. Because even though you are my chief disciple, and even though you have total faith in the Buddha, and you have and you know from personal experience that everything that I've taught has been trustworthy, and you've heard these words from my own mouth itself, even so, you don't then presume that what I'm saying is true and useful, but you recognize that you have to take it and test it in your own life and apply it and see for yourself whether what the result of this is indeed beneficial and good, or whether it's harmful. So this is a really useful criteria to work with. And so rather than looking for certainty or completeness or stability in our life by finding the perfect religious map, or the perfect conceptual map, the perfect ideological map, a perfect scientific map of life and the universe and everything, far better to say, well, all maps can only be relatively useful. So that's not throw all the maps away, but realize that that's not the absolute point of it, but to instead turn the attention to the very experience of this moment, and to see for ourselves what is it that we do to handle this moment. How do we relate to this moment, to this feeling of success or failure, the feeling of happiness or unhappiness, the feeling of comfort or discomfort? What do we do with it? What do we do with this neutral, nondescript moment? What do we do with it? How do we relate to this moment? And that this whole question of dukkha and the ending of dukkha, or dissatisfaction, disharmony and the ending of disharmony, it's not some kind of grand cosmic philosophy or talking about the beginning and end of the universe or big bangs and big crunches, but it's talking, it brings it right back to this very moment now. Here we are at 9:05 on Saturday night, the 21st of July, 2007, Earth time. Here we are, this moment. What's the mind doing with this feeling? With the ache in your leg, or the feeling of being a bit warm, or the feeling of being interested, the feeling of being bored, the feeling of needing to go to the bathroom, the feeling of, I wonder if I should go out for a pizza tonight. Feeling of, oh, I shouldn't be thinking about pizza. I'm in the middle of a Dhamma talk. I'm a bad, bad yogi. Bad yogi, no pizza. What does the mind do with that? Then the feeling of, how did he know I was thinking that? Gee, I better be careful. What does the mind do with that? So we're bringing this the capacity of the mind to pay attention, to be mindful, to let the mind be full of this moment, to allow the attention to be drawn right to this moment, and see that it's not the way that we describe the world that makes a difference, whether we use a Buddhist model or a Christian model or a scientific model or a Jewish model or a no model, a non-model model, a psychological model or an astrological model or the whatever it might be. It's rather looking right at this attitude with which we pick up all models, or any model, or no model. And this is the key piece, really, in what the Buddha, the Buddha of Buddhism is. The Buddha means that root, the Pali and Sanskrit root Buddha means intelligence or knowing. It means awareness. So the Buddha of Buddhism is the quality of knowing, of awareness, that observant, watching quality of our own heart. So it's in a way paying attention to the attitude. It's a kind of, maybe it's an attitudism, is a good translation for Buddhism. Awakened attitudism. Kind of clumsy, but also accurate. So because we're turning the attention back onto the moment, onto this, the attitude with which we pick up sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the body, the mind, the world inside, the world outside. How conditioned is the heart towards busyness, towards activity? How conditioned is it towards fearfulness or aggression, towards love, towards kindness, towards generosity? How conditioned is it towards self-concern or concern for others? And so what we find is that, and this is why one of the uses of Buddhist meditation, developing the capacity of focus, the capacity of investigation, exploring the qualities of mind, is the capacity to bring a careful and close attention to even the fine details, the fine texture of the way the mind reacts to each moment, to what we think, what we feel, our emotions, what we see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. And development of meditation, the development of refinement of concentration, the refinement of wisdom, of investigation of reality, is that we find that, well, it doesn't, the important thing is not the pattern that we have to describe the universe, whether our experience is pleasant or painful or neutral, whether we're experiencing success or failure, health or sickness, old age or youth, masculinity, femininity. Those are all secondary to the way that we pick them up, the attitude we have towards it. And that we find that if there is an open-heartedness, if the attitude that is established is one of receptivity, open-heartedness, and non-clinging, non-entanglement, and non-possessiveness. So we open our heart to the way things are, to know it without confusion, but not to get stuck on it. Then, when we experience the pleasant and the beautiful and the delightful, then we can taste that sweet flavor. But we're not going to get drunk on it, carried away, or possessive about it. When we experience pain and bitterness, loss and failure and fragmentation, then again we know that bitter taste. We know that sharpness, that painfulness. But again, we're not going to get frantic about it or reactive or possessive about that. So this is a bitter taste. It arises, it ceases. Here it is. So that what we find is that when we establish that kind of attitude, that there's a wonderful attunement that we experience within the heart. There's that non-reactivity doesn't make us into like a neutralized zombie, like sort of perfecting the art of being a video camera. It just sort of records data, you know, perceives objects and records them. It's not that at all. What happens is that when there is that really impartial, unbiased way of embracing each moment, the heart aligns with the way things are, and so we're able to first of all recognize our reactive patterns, and then not be dragged in by them, not to be pulled along by them. You know, seeing what patterns lead towards painfulness and what patterns lead towards happiness. And then those that lead towards pain and stress and difficulty between ourselves and others, we find that we can train the heart to not follow those, to just leave those alone, to let them fade. And the ones that lead to benefit, towards happiness, towards greater harmony between ourselves and others and within ourselves, then we find that the strength to empower those, to embolden those, to stabilize those qualities, strengthen them, give them life. So in a way, it's just taking responsibility for our own liberation, our own happiness, our own freedom. Because when we take this responsibility and not just go on belief or on structures that are handed to us from outside or passed on by logic or belief or just inherited from the social system that we happen to have landed in, then we experience the benefit of that ourselves. It's a direct realization, a direct liberation. We know that truth. The heart knows that reality for itself. And even though we might not be able to explain, and all the minutiae of how the universe got to be the way it is and how it all works and what's the fundamental nature of life, the universe and everything, what we find is miraculously we can be in harmony with it even if we can't explain it, even if we don't have a perfect image or a description for it. So an image that I like to use for this is that of an orchestra. So that it's a kind of slightly less military version of the wounded the wounded soldier. It's like if you're in an orchestra, rather than trying to find the names of all the different details about the person who shot you, it's rather like if you wanted to write mathematical equations for the musical sound of all the different instruments, what's happening to the oscillating air within the trombones and the trumpets, the brass section, the vibrations of metal, and the unique patterns of viscosity and air movement in the curves of the tuba or the sousaphone. What's happening in the strings of the violins and inside the sound boxes of the violins, inside the timpani, the big drums. What's going on inside the flutes and the piccolos and that again, you could write formulae and do calculations for years and years and years just to describe the wave forms and mechanics of sound of a 50-piece orchestra just on the first note, just the opening bar of Beethoven's Fifth. Da 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 da. It could take you 50 years just to describe everything that's going on in that little burst of music. But you don't have to be able to write formulae for every single nuance of every instrument in the orchestra in order to be in harmony with it. If you're on the second violins, you have the notes that you play in that opening bar, then you can play that and you can be in harmony with the rest of the orchestra. Totally in harmony, perfectly in harmony, without being able to describe. Even in, say, the finger movements or arm movements, body movements for any of the other musicians. You just your piece. Here are my notes. Here's my instrument. You do your bit, and then there you are in harmony. The music is harmonious. That's all we need to know. And so that's like the handful of leaves. That's what we need to know. And when we know that, then we find that quality of alignment. Our life is in tune with nature, and you can use that language like being one with nature. But it's a very even that can sound a little bit abstract or remote. But it's that quality of that we all know of being in tune. That quality of, right. And even before the mind thinks, right. It's that quality of recognition in the heart, of knowing, that attribute of trueness, of rightness, of harmonization. And this is the purpose of Buddha's teachings, whether it's northern tradition, southern tradition, Vajrayana, Theravada, Mahayana, all true spiritual paths lead towards just that simple. They're ways of catalyzing that ultimately simple and subtle shift from the state of disharmony and dislocation to harmonization and sustaining that for our own benefit and for the benefit of everybody else in the orchestra and everyone else who's listening. Yeah, our own harmonization intrinsically blesses the lives of others. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.
Andamayam dhamma kataya sadhukaram kadamase
sadhukaram.